problem is that cosmic rays, which are actually charged particles, are considered radiation. And so our magnetic field blocks a lot of the alpha and beta particles, which are charged either high energy electrons and beta particles, and ionize the helium nuclei in alpha particles. But gamma rays are not affected in the slightest from the Earth's magnetic field.
So gamma radiation, like electric fields, does not deflect when it comes in contact with the magnetic field. And you mentioned alpha. What others are deflected?
I think I mentioned beta twice, so I'll mention it a third time. Beta, they're electrons that are traveling at very high velocity.
Absolutely agree. Thank you very much, and to exchange.
Okay, thank you. We have a little bit more time, so I will pull out of my back pocket something I mentioned a few weeks ago, a puzzle that I teased out of ChatGPT, although I kind of let it there. A lot of times when I kind of take a look at how people interact with ChatGPT, there's a lot of guiding on the part of the person on the other end. It's a fascinating piece of software, but it's not self-aware. It's obviously not self-aware from what I've seen and my interactions with it. Anyway, getting back, I was talking about neutron stars. I always find stars fascinating. What happens with stars in general is you have this large cloud of mostly hydrogen, a little helium. Depending upon the age of the star, it could have heavier atoms involved. And gravitational forces push it all together. And as it squeezes it together, the enormous pressure on a massive hydrogen cloud under an incredible gravitational field produces the spark of a fusion, where hydrogen is combined, the nuclei of hydrogen atoms are combined and eventually form helium, and the binding energy that's released is released in energy, which produces a great deal of heat and gamma rays, and that heat produces an external pressure that equilibrates with the gravitational pressure pushing it all together. So as long as the sun is burning in the sky, the outward pressure is balancing things out, and the star is pretty stable. Let me drop for a second. The interesting thing is when the fuel starts to run out. Now, some stars are big enough and hot enough and powerful enough that when they use up their hydrogen, they go to helium. When they use up their helium, they go on to the next lithium. And they just keep going down the periodic table, fusing them together and extracting energy. You can do that as far as iron in the periodic table. Beyond iron, it becomes an endothermic reaction instead of an exothermic. You need to supply more energy to produce the reaction. So all stars would never get past iron. But when these stars kind of lose the pressure of the exploding fusion reaction, they're unopposed by unopposed force allows gravity to squeeze them closer and closer and closer together. And at one final point, there's something called the Pauli exclusion principle, which suggests that particles like electrons and protons and neutrons can't occupy the same space. Photons, which are called bosons, can occupy. You can have a billion photons in the same exact space-time. But you can't do that with electrons and protons and neutrons unless you have a lot of force. So the force of massive stars can collapse electrons and protons together and fuse them and create neutrons and a lot of energy. This causes the star to erupt and blast apart, and what's left behind is a substance made chiefly of neutrons alone. Neutronium, or as we lovely call it, we like to call it neutron star. So that's the beauty of a neutron star. They are incredibly dense, incredibly heavy. A neutron star could occupy roughly the same dimensions as Manhattan Island and weigh the same amount as more than our star, our sun in the sky. So we have this incredibly dense, highly gravitational object called a neutron star. Now, the puzzle that ChatGPT suggested to me is, if you were able to protect a transmitter from the environment of a neutron star, and if you had this transmitter set with a battery, and it's transmitting 100 watts at 10 megahertz, and you put it on the surface of a neutron star, and you tune in far away, would there be any odd change to receiving a signal? You have two transmitters. One transmitter is sitting on top of a neutron star, protected from its effects. The other one is out in free space. You point your receiver at one, you point your receiver at the other. They're about equal distance away from you. Is there any difference in the characteristics of the transmitted signal in free space and the one sitting on a neutron star? That's the question.
Not sure how to answer that. You specified a little bit more. Because we're talking about propagation of electromagnetic wave in dense medium.
Well, ultimately, yeah, that's exactly what it is. You have a source of electromagnetic radiation in a free space, and you have another source of electromagnetic radiation very, very close to an incredibly dense, not a black hole, but still a very, very gravitationally intense force. Does that change any quality of the transmission as you receive it?
Okay. Enter XGN. We're dealing with electrodynamics, QED, and electromagnetic wave is in transfer and longitudinal direction. It means that in extremely dense medium, electromagnetic wave develop a longitudinal component when they propagate in such dense medium. And then medium response to electromagnetic wave indicates that the electromagnetic properties of dense material are modified as a result of interaction of electromagnetic wave with that matter. So, of course, we can calculate it using QED expressions for the electromagnetic properties such as electric permittivity, magnetic permeability, and refractive index or dense matter, and we could obtain those results. So, we have two factors that makes a communication possible or impossible at all. And to actually...
You're going on a false supposition. The electromagnetic waves are traveling in free space. One is being affected by intense gravitational fields. The other one is not. They're not going through a substance. They're going through the vacuum of space. But one is sitting on top of a neutron star, and the other one isn't. So it's not really that it's going through dense material. It's going through pretty much the same vacuum, both of them. It's just one of them is experiencing this very, very, very precipitously close to an incredibly dense magnetic field.
But the difference between the transmitter and the receiver, the signal between the transmitter and the receiver has to go through that star. Do I understand it properly?
No, it doesn't go through the star. It goes out from the star. It's on the surface or above the surface. I make no difference. As I said, the bit of magic is you're shielding it from the destructive effects of a neutron star. If you were able to stand on a neutron star, within a fraction of a fraction of a second, you would end up being compressed to a pancake and probably just would mix together with it and be part of the neutron star made out of only neutrons. But for the sake of this experiment, the radio waves are only traveling through the vacuum of space in both cases. One is just very close to a gravitational field, the other isn't.
I have a problem with the description, because every puzzle has to have a solid basis. Neutron stars are a unique example of extremely dense objects in the universe, and they contain most of the matter in the form of neutrons. So material in those stars is in the highly degenerate form, and density is comparable to atomic nuclei. So we're talking about the Fermi level. Temperature in the stars is very high, and particles have ultra-relativistic energy. So I don't see the solid basis for it. Maybe I don't understand the question.
It is a theoretical question. Theoretical questions almost always are not practical. We talked about this many times in the past. It is just a theoretical construct to get at a fundamental concept a little bit easier. So, like I said before, we're doing magic here because in the real world you couldn't do this experiment because being close to that gravitational field would totally destroy your transmitter. But I'm saying that on a theoretical basis, if you had some kind of a transmitter that wasn't destroyed by the gravitational field, would the gravitational field have an effect other than to destroy it? And what would be the nature of the gravitational field changing some characteristic of a transmitter?
I don't know. But I ask a question that will help. Does the electromagnetic wave has quantum interactions with or ultra relativistic particle dynamics with the entropy?
I don't know. I think you're throwing words. I'll give you a clue that the principle of interest here is relativistic. So, not so much gravitational, because unfortunately there is no really well understood quantum gravity to use out there. So, all the gravitational theory at this point tends to be relativistic theory.
I don't know the answer. All I know is that the quantum interaction, along with ultra relativistic particle dynamics, make material very complex, and we could talk about the pulsars also rotating and stuff like that with large magnetic fields, but I don't know the answer.
Okay. Anyone else out there with any ideas or want to join us in this conversation, please feel free. Hit that push to talk button.
Copy, KATUCF.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. The transmitter survives because you're making allowances for that. So you're talking about propagation of a radio wave. And it is not immune from the composition, the material composition of the star. Am I correct?
It's not going through the material composition. It's say it's hovering, I don't know, a mile above and somehow protected by magic. So it's not interacting with the materials on the neutron star. What I'm interested in for this little puzzle that ChatGPT came up with is how the gravitational field might affect the transmitter.
Might affect the transmitter or the propagating wave?
The propagating wave.
Are we to assume that the immediate environs around the surface of the star might interact with that wave?
It's only the gravitational aspect.
WB2BSO with a cover.
There's something in here with relativity.
Yes, I mentioned before, it's relativity. Also, Frank from Philadelphia, he's on Echolink. What did you want to say, Frank?
Yeah, thanks. It's a bit of a challenge to get in here because the pauses the repeater's beep requires aren't quite long enough. In any case, misunderstanding something, but I think the question is being overcomplicated. If I remember correctly, in a deep gravity well or in any gravity well, time moves slower. Maybe I have that backwards. But time is different inside, in and outside of a gravity well. I think it's slower in a gravity well. And since frequency and wavelength are a function of time, then the transmitter's frequency would be different than the transmitter of the frequency, than the frequency of the transmitter. With the same inherent frequency in free space. Am I right?
That's the way relativity would have it.
Yes, it's called time dilation. It's actually seen with very accurate clocks, atomic clocks. If you have an atomic clock on ground level and you take an atomic clock up a mountain, they're going to have a slightly different time because the gravitational field is stronger and the time dilation effect is greater on the surface. It's also necessary to correct for relativistic changes for GPS systems. The satellite clocks don't run at the same rate that ground level clocks because of the gravitational field being stronger on the surface of the Earth.
Is that the signal from the transmitter on or near the surface of a neutron star, on the assumption that the transmitter could physically exist there, you're making that assumption, that in any case the frequency would be different, even if their the observed frequency would be different, even if their VFOs show that they're on the same frequency, am I right?
Correct. So the only thing left to do, and you got a 50-50 random chance, is to predict whether the perceived frequency from free space pointed at that neutron star transmitter, whether that transmitter frequency has either gone up or gone down.
The wavelength is longer.
Which means?
Inverse of frequency.
The frequency goes down. I think that was on the novice exam.
Okay, but unfortunately, although there is a local effect of the wavelength, you got to kind of, I think, go back to the time signal in a gravity well. The local time frame is slower than it is for us in a gravitation-free area. So when you correct for the time rate difference, the effect of transmitter frequency, the way we perceive it, if you were right next to the transmitter at the site of the neutron star, I gave the rate at 10 megahertz. It would be 10 megahertz. But as you went farther and farther away from the neutron star and you weren't in the gravitational well and the time dilation effect didn't exist for you, you would perceive the clock rate as going faster from that perspective than in the gravitational valley. So the time constant goes up and the frequency goes up. So the transmitter frequency would actually increase outside of the gravity well. It slows down as you get closer to the gravity well.
That's a lot of fun.
Okay, well, thanks to ChatGPT. I kind of force-fed it to neutron stars because I have another puzzle that entails neutron stars, and it thankfully finally gave me something useful, and I discussed it with it because it gave the question. It didn't give the answer, so I just wanted to make sure we were both on the same page. But I hope you enjoyed it. It really is ultimately a practical puzzle because it has importance in how GPTs work, GBSs work. The timing accuracy requires relativistic corrections because of the differing gravitational fields of satellites versus Earth-based time clocks. So I hope you guys enjoyed it and it wasn't too confusing.
KHGPS, do I have it?
Yep.
I know you're towards the end of the net. I was just wondering if anybody had brought up the new discovery of mature galaxies way too far, way too early in time.
Now, that's an interesting one. I didn't kind of think of bringing that up because I thought maybe Paul might want to do it. And also, there's really nothing but questions, a lot of interesting questions, but I don't know of any answers anyone has yet. I don't know what to make of it, but I agree with you. It is fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we have to rethink the entire evolution of the universe.
Well, I hope not. I hope there's an easier solution for it. We've talked before that there is a difference between the edge of the observable universe and the edge of the actual universe, whatever that might be or mean. No one really knows the actual size of the entire universe, again, whatever that means, because we are limited by the speed of light in a vacuum. We can only see a certain distance, and beyond that point, we simply cannot see it. And since it is traveling faster than the speed of light in a vacuum, in the opposite direction, the edge, it's never going to get any better. It's just going to get worse. And before someone says, "I thought you can't travel faster than the speed of light in a vacuum," space itself, or space-time itself, can travel at any speed. There is no limitation to the speed of expansion or scaling of space-time. It's things traveling through space-time, their causality, that is limited by the speed of light.
Yes, that is so. However, the hypothesis that there was a Big Bang of some instance and inflation and the acceleration of expansion and all these things might fall into question given the presence of these galaxies if they're confirmed.
Well, perhaps the Big Bang is still an unproven theory. It's well founded in a lot of technical information, but there are still questions abound, it might change. Keep in mind that back in the 80s, there were a large group of people who kind of believed in cyclical universes, that what happened, they thought, was that over time the universe acceleration away from the center slowed down and gravity overcame the force of the motion and the entire universe would come together as a zero-dimensional point and explode again. Not really explode, but the Big Bang would happen again, and that this is an infinite series of Big Bang Big Crushes. That was before they realized that the speed of the universe expanding is increasing over time, not decreasing.
A few information about propagation of electromagnetic waves in neutron stars.
I'll make a last comment.
Okay, Gary.
Maybe we just don't have the cognitive circuitry to conceive, what was before the Big Bang, just as we don't have the ability to really understand the limitlessness of space. as Heisenberg once said, should be able to think on both sides of a limit. That's what a limit means. But to think of something as limitless, you know, and that the infinity of space means that, you know, occupied, unoccupied, or, you know, vacuum, no vacuum, all these questions become kind of irrelevant.
Well, I mean, at what point do you hit the stop button? I think we should strive to understand as much as our minds are capable of understanding. And we will only realize that limit when we reach it. So people could have said the same thing 2,000 years ago, and technology would have stopped at that point. So I think the striving is as important as getting someplace. Again, it's a trite phrase sometimes, but the journey is just as important as the destination.
And the metaphysics just as important as the physics. Okay, K-A-T-U-T-F, cheerio.
Okay, cheerio. Wesley, I would love to discourse with you. It's already 10:30. I already feel bad that I was, supposed to hand it over to Paul. So if you want to discuss this next week, the problem is that what I'm talking at least about is gravitational effects. And quantum gravity is incredibly ill-defined with the exception of... I'm blanking on his name, the radiation from black holes, the thermal radiation, is a consequence of a very special case of Stephen Hawking's radiation. It is a very limited aspect of quantum gravity that is explainable, but that's about it. So I don't think the audience would care for a discourse on quantum gravity, but, you know, if you want to talk about it next week, we'll see. So is that okay with you, Wes? Can I move on to the SpaceNet report?
I have less than 1 minute, so it's okay.
Okay, next week. Anyway, once again, thanks to everyone who participated, and I hope the people who sat there and listened enjoyed themselves. And maybe someday they'll participate as well. It's a painless experience. I find it loads of fun and educational. You never know when you're going to learn something. So anyway, thanks to everyone. I'll be back at 11 to say to wrap it up. But until then, here's Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
Thanks for H2GS WS2N. And is Rich still there? He was...
I am, Paul. I am still here. And first of all, can you hear me? Because the Middle Island link sometimes drops.
Oh, okay. No, you're doing great right now. So no problem, Rich. And thanks, Roy. Good net so far. Wonderful. Topics. And over to you, Rich. This is WS1, Paul for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
Yeah, hi, Paul and everyone. By the way, Roy, the Rig Expert DNA worked perfectly and showed me the line that I was expecting. So I got to open up this DNA, maybe. Re-solder, re-ball some joints or whatever. I don't know. Anyway, Paul, I'm an extra, so I back then I had to take, you know, the 20 words a minute. Had to be proficient in 20 words a minute. So I got the speed up to that, but that was a long time ago. I've just gotten back into CW now for the past, like 3 months, and I'm struggling to get above 15 words a minute, and especially with my sending and with a paddle. So instead of discouraging myself, I thought that I would try a straight key, which I bought from Amazon. It's a nice little straight key, but I'm wondering how fast do you think someone could go with a straight key? I don't mean, you know, back in the Pony Express days. I mean, just realistically, how fast do you think, you know, a straight key affords an operator, and then beyond that, you have to get into a paddle? Over to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have two keys that are hooked up in parallel. The one is the iambic key. So that's the one that, of course, I use all the time. And my sending speed, of course, is slower than my receiving speed. Because usually, you know, when I'm in a queue stop, because I'm thinking, well, what word am I sending next? So, you know, if I get up to 18 words a minute for transmitting, I'm happy. You know, if it's a contest, you know, yeah, I can go over 20 words a minute because, you know, you're just sending, you know, the call letters, and, you know, 599, and, you know, all you have to do is get the call letters, transmit the call sign, you know, so no problem there. But in a regular queue cell, if I can get to 18 words transmitting, I'm happy. But some of the guys, of course, are sending it a lot, you know, 20 words back or more. And luckily, I can copy faster than I can transmit. So that's the standing operating procedure. In parallel, I have the straight key hooked up. It's just a Radio Shack straight key. Sometimes you come across somebody that's learning. You know, they're new, you know. They're going very slow. So I'll actually switch from the iambic key to slow down drastically, you know, to make sure that this guy gets the cue cell through, because you don't want any new people to get frustrated, and you know, you want them to keep on going. You don't want to just lose them as contact. So I do that quite a bit when that happens. But of course, on straight key night, I'll use it as well. And I would say fastest I could do is maybe, if I get up to 10 words or 12 words a minute with the straight key transmitting, I'm lucky, you know. It's slow and tiresome. It's so much easier with the paddle, especially with the iambic paddle. Back to you, Richard.
Yeah, you know, I've been having that problem with the paddle where past a certain speed it gets away from me. You know, like when you're sending a V instead of a 4, or, you know, a H instead of a 5, sometimes that extra dit gets in there when I don't want it to. I don't feel as in control. So I bought the straight key, and I like the tactile feel of it. I think I'm faster than 10 words a minute with it, especially if you go by the, what's that form of CW? I forget his name, where the letters together are faster than the actual speed, because the spaces between the letters are longer. I forget what it's called. But anyway, it's a method. And I send like that when I'm using the straight key. I've only had it, you know, for a couple of days. I feel much more in control of it than I do of the paddle. And but still, there's a learning, muscle memory learning curve with the straight key also. It was $72. It's a little thing called a Puda cake. I think they're made in Russia. I'm not sure where they're made. Maybe the Ukraine. Hopefully the Ukraine. So my dollars went there. But, you know, I have to decide after a couple of weeks whether I'm going to keep it or not. That's pretty expensive when I already have a bench or paddle. But I think I'll keep going with it. If it makes it more enjoyable, why not? It's money well worth spent. Money well spent. Money spent well. All right. I haven't had any QSOs with it because that DX contest was on this week. Let me let it drop a second. And so when I get into a few QSOs, I'll know if I really enjoy it much more than the paddle. I just hope it doesn't limit my speed. You know what I mean? If I get comfortable at 10 words or 14 words a minute and don't get beyond that, you know, of course I'd like to get back up to that 20 words a minute that I once had back in the 90s. Anyway, you answered my question, and I thank you. Let me let you get on with the space report. W2BZ.
Okay, Rich, very good. And Farnsworth, is that the guy? Anyway, this is my speed. So that's my regular speed for the here. I haven't timed it in a long time, so you know, give you an idea. If you're anything close to that on the straight key, you're doing great. But that's the iambic here. Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, I can get it. I can get it about three quarters that fast on the straight key, and hopefully I'll get a little faster on it. But right now, you know, I don't want to discourage myself from CW. I really love CW when it's going well, but when I can't copy because it's too fast, or when I can't send accurately because I'm going too fast, it doesn't become fun, and that's the whole reason for this hobby, is to have fun. So that's why I got the straight key. I'll see. I'll report back to you, Paul, about it. Maybe we could speak during the week or whatever. So back to you, Paul. Thanks for taking the time to answer the questions.
Very good. Okay. And, CW I liked. Getting to ham radio, taking the test. But, to me, that was the fun part. The hard part was the technical part, you know. So I did not come from an electronic background, so that was there. But very good, Rich. Let me cover a couple topics before the clock ticks down here. This is WS2N. Somebody launches during the month now, like this month. We're already a couple of days in, and there's still 15 launches worldwide that, you know, popular launches that will be going up. So it's like every other day another launch, so we can't cover them all. But the one I'm paying attention to is on the 8th, Thursday, Relativity taking off from Cape Canaveral down Florida. This is a brand new company, and they're going to launch the Terran 1 rocket. That'll be their first attempt to get to orbit. And it should be interesting because a lot of these companies are switching over to methane fuels. SpaceX is leading the way with their Starship. The thing is, nobody has got a rocket into orbit yet with methane, and relativity has a chance to be the first. China just tried it, a month or so ago, and it failed. It didn't make it to orbit, so this would be the first. I'd like to see it accomplished. Also, this company is building the whole booster, second stage, everything. All the tanks and everything are being built with 3D additive manufacturing. That's a big accomplishment. Many companies, including SpaceX, are making parts, or some companies practically a whole engine out of 3D. With 3D printers. This company decided to make it the whole rocket with a 3D printer. So they set up a massive, they say it's the biggest printer in the world that they have set up doing this. And if it's successful, it's going to be another big step forward.
Rocket Lab was thinking about doing it when they were building their rocket, but they opted out. They did go with their engines, the full Rutherford engines. A lot of those parts are 3D printed. But this company actually went for it, and hope they make it. It's an aluminum. It's like bead after bead going down. You know, it's an aluminum aluminum tank. It's not a carbon composite tank. These things are made out of actual aluminum. So we'll see. If that makes it, they plan on building another rocket very soon after this, much larger. Bigger engines. The engines are going to be roughly 10 times the size as the engines they're using on this one. So this is a prototype. They don't have a satellite that they're putting into space. I guess nobody wants to roll the dice with a brand new company, a brand new a rocket. But if it's successful, you know, they have people signed up. They have a manifest ready to go. Relativity is the name of it, and I'm looking forward to it. Thursday window opens at 1 o'clock, and I think it ends around 4 o'clock. Daytime. Any comments? WS2M. All right, it's giving Frank a chance for anybody else on the go link. So, the other big news, of course, is Crew Dragon. Number 6 has made it to the International Space Station. They were supposed to launch right after this net last week. I stayed up for I think 1:30 in the morning or so. And, you know, it got down to the last 2 minutes, and they called it. They wound up aborting the mission because of a problem with the ignition system. It's the first crew abort that SpaceX has had. They've, with this launch, it'll be a total of 9 different launches with people on board. This is the 6th one that's going to the International Space Station. So they call it Crew 6, four people on board. But the ignition system, they were getting a bad sensor reading, so I don't know if a valve wasn't opening or if it was just a bad sensor. So without that ignition fuel, they decided to postpone it. What they use is this triethyl aluminum mixed with triethyl boron, so they call it TTAB. And a lot of rockets run on this stuff as an ignition. They force these two together, and it's kind of like a hypergolic type of reaction. They just come in contact with each other with oxygen or maybe just water vapor in the air, and they automatically ignite. And that's what ignites main fuel. For instance, on Falcon 9, the main fuel is kerosene and liquid oxygen. To get that going, they use this TTAB stuff, this triethyl aluminum and triethyl boron. The boron part of it gives it that greenish color. So you ever see these launches, especially like with SpaceX, you'll see like a greenish glow, right? You know, with 3, 2, 1, 0, you'll see that around 2 seconds because they're forcing TTAB through it. And anyway, apparently they must have straightened this thing out, and they wound up getting off the pad 2 days later. They are now firmly docked with the International Space Station. Not without one issue. They have these closing latches that they need to operate properly when they dock with the space station. And they have motors that drive these latches. And they have, like anything in the space program, they have a backup system. So one of the latches and was not functioning, they were able to use the backup motor and all the latches, three main latches that really grab the they go through a soft dock and then a hard dock. They were able to now complete that properly before they got to the space station. It's like 24 hours or so before they actually get to the space station. They sent up a software patch to get around this latching problem. So that's good. Those four people have now joined seven others on board, temporarily anyway. They will be living with 11 people on board the space station. So, okay. Before I go on, any comments? And I'll leave a little pause in case Echo Link needs to get through. WS2S.
Thank you. When you, John.
Okay, John. I heard a cue in there, so it went by a little too quick for me. Back to you, John.
This is November, Quebec. Yeah, thanks. Your first comment, your first topic, reminded me of something I wanted to ask you about. There was discussion a while ago about considering using 3D printers and using the material that exists on various structures like the Moon or Mars, and not even taking up any construction material, but just using whatever's around in a sophisticated 3D printer. Do you know if that is a reasonable discussion still, or was it just blue sky stuff?
Long term, they plan on actually using the regolith from the Moon or different materials from Mars. When they go to Mars, and the theory is that they could use that to actually maybe build facilities, living quarters. Of course, you'd have to somehow drag this massive 3D machine up there, but, I could imagine, maybe a couple of decades from now, doing something like that. Building bead after bead of, some kind of material to build up walls and even ceilings. You could do all that. It's possible. I live in Montcalm, and there's this one street I drive to if I want to go to, let's say, Walmart. On the right-hand side, there's this house. I mean, it was nothing there. And they set up this 3D machine. This thing was massive. And over the last, it's been built already, but when it was being built, it took, I would say, about 3 months, because once in a while I drive past, and maybe a total of 3 months to build this house, from scratch. And, I would drive by, a month later, and this thing would be, one-third built. And sure enough, eventually they put some kind of nice siding on it. The windows were all planned out, and this thing kept on going. It looked like some kind of, looked like a concrete substance or something like, might have been, some kind of a form of concrete. I don't know, but they built this whole house in a 3D. With a 3D machine. It's a one story, but I can picture in the future somebody building two-story houses like this. And I don't know how cost effective it is, but it's done, and I don't know if anybody's living there yet. But I would imagine, John, they could do this way in the future with using the materials from the Moon or even Mars. Back to you, John.
Yeah, thanks. I didn't think it was too soon, but I didn't know if there was any, if you knew of any current research to work on. I'm sure somebody in some lab is playing around trying to put sand together and build a house. And maybe this thing you saw was a great prototype, and it just sounds like it's a pretty tedious operation. Anyway, thanks for the comment. I appreciate your report and that comment. I'll stand by. This is NQ1U.
Very good, NQ1U WS2N. For the SpaceNet report. Yeah, and this was done on one lot, you know, it's like a corner lot, you know. So I could picture driving by something with like acres and acres one day and seeing these machines, go, you know, doing this in mass production, you know. And then once they do that, of course, you know, that would drive the prices way down. So I'd be curious to find out what this thing actually sold for. But, right now I'm looking at my core letters that were made with a 3D machine. My grandson programmed it into a 3D machine and came out with WS2N. And pretty incredible. Okay, any other comments? Okay, unusual story I saw recently was about this company. It's called Spaceport Company, and they're planning on building a floating platform that could go out to sea and launch rockets from this floating platform. Now this is, let's call it a prototype. The one that the Spaceport Company is building, and they plan on actually launching their first rocket, not an orbital flight, suborbital flight, from this thing in May, and that would be their first launch. It's going to be on the Atlantic, from the Atlantic side, I think, eventually on the Atlantic side. Right now it's down in the Gulf, they said. But this company, if successful, plans on making bigger ones. And they have these, you know, imagine a big platform, and it's got four rising, both pipes, massive pipes, one on each corner, vertically. When I first saw it, I thought, what is this? Maybe they're going to have some kind of antenna structures, you know, not a structure, a lightning rod, a structure or something, and they show a rocket in the middle. But they, I mean, these things were thick. And then I read the article. What this is telescopic pipes inside one another that's going to, you know, be hydraulically pushed straight down through the surface of the water until they hit bedrock. In this case, they're able to go down 60 feet, so they can't go out too far. So, if they hit 60 feet, that's going to stabilize this platform. It won't rock, it won't move. The rocket, the suborbital rocket, in this case, will raise vertical, and they're going to launch it. So, if that's successful, I guess it probably takes money, maybe more investors or something. That plan is to eventually build bigger ones where you could actually launch them, launch orbital rockets from sea. Years ago they did this in the 1990s, mid-1990s, there was a sea-based launch system. They called it a sea launch. It was a group of, I believe it was, four countries involved. Norway, Russia,
complete.
Ukraine, and the United States. They had this system where they would put, they called it the Zenith rocket on this platform, and they would float it out to sea and go to the equator. If you get out to near the equator, it's less, they can put more payload up in a, let's say, a geosynchronous orbit. Because the rotation of the Earth, probably 1,000 mile an hour head start by going to the equator compared to the North Pole. So they did this, they launched dozens of these rockets, these Zenit 3 SL rockets. And in fact, those rockets were manufactured in the Ukraine, of all places. So eventually that whole deal fell apart after a couple of dozen launches. Different problems, the lawsuits back and forth, so they stopped doing that. Now China has developed a similar system, and I think they might have launched one rocket so far from their floating barge. But anyway, this company plans on doing the exact same thing. They figure there's a market for it because there's so many launches going up. Like I said, 15 just in this month alone. And that's only going to be increasing. So this company, Spaceport Company, believes that they can build a number of these platforms and launch as many rockets as they want from the sea, which I think is pretty cool. I just wanted to get up one other story before. I know it's getting late. Let me just finish this one other story. March is Women's History Month. So, I found this one piece of space news, you might call it, or older news. About this woman that was launched into space with the Russians, and her name is Helena Sharman, and she comes out of the UK. Turns out she was the first person from the UK ever to go into orbit. There's been two people after that, but she was the first, and it was a crazy deal. What happened was, it was not a reality TV show, but maybe something similar to that. They called it Project Juno. And they just wanted somebody, anybody from the UK, to be the first person to go into orbit. And they had 13,000 people try out, submit for work. And this one, Helena Sharman, eventually won. And she wound up with a call letter. GB1MIR, and MIR, because she was getting launched with two Russians to the Mir space station, which operated from 1986 or so to 1999. They had like a good 15-year run. Well, in the middle of all of that, Ms. Sharman got blasted to the Mir space station. Spent 8 days there. Not long, but 8 days. And during those 8 days, she did some science work, but did a lot of communication because she had this ham call, and she wound up contacting about 9 schools in Great Britain, and which I thought was pretty good. Sure enough, the first person, in this case a woman, from the UK, also happened to be she wound up on a ham radio ticket. She didn't have a license before she started, but she got made sure that they made sure that she had this before she went up. So, and then there was there was a person in England that recorded one of the school contacts that she made. He had a rig, and he was just copying the Q cells. So, you can actually go to this website. You can read all about this person, the whole program, this Project Juno that